All right, we are ready for Exodus chapters 22 to 24, and we are finishing up the second major section of our outline as Baxter has outlined it. We've dealt with the Exodus, and we are now dealing with the law section. Now, the law is going to continue on, not only through this book, but through Deuteronomy. But as the book unfolds, we have a section dealing with the commandments, judgments, and ordinances. And we're going to finish chapters 22, 23, 24, and the next time we're getting into the tabernacle. So we'll get into the design of the tabernacle and the elements that are found there, the furnishings, the size, etc. We'll get into all that in our study next time. So this basically is the law. Now, this isn't all the details of the law, though you may think it is, as we get into the section. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1. All right, children of Israel are suffering in Egypt, chapter 2. Very good, chapter 3. Yeah. All right, and because, very good, because he was called, he started making excuses, chapter 4, made his trip to Egypt. Chapter 5, yeah, he went to Pharaoh and things got worse. Then chapter 6. God needed to do something for Moses and Israel. Yes, very good. Gave them assurance. So starting with chapter 7, we have the plagues. First plague, chapter 8, is second, third, and fourth. Chapter 9, fifth, sixth, and seventh. And chapter 10, yeah, eighth and ninth. And then chapter 11, you'd think would be the 10th, but it is the announcement concerning the 10th. Chapter 12 was the actual 10th plague. We have the Passover. We'll come back to that chapter a little bit later. Chapter 13. All right, yes. We have the firstborn sanctified, and notice the Feast of Unleavened Bread. If you've prepared for tonight, you've seen that in your study tonight in chapter 23. So we'll flag that a little bit later. Chapter 14. That was the actual Exodus, wasn't it? Chapter 15, because they came out. Yeah, here was the celebration, the song of deliverance. Chapter 16, manna from heaven. Chapter 17, water from the rock, and there was the war with Amalekites. Chapter 18, yeah, overwhelmed and needed some help. Chapter 19, last week. Yeah, this was at Sinai, the preparation to receive the law. Everybody ought to be familiar with chapter 20. It is the Ten Commandments. And then chapter 21. Yeah, some of the details and amplification of those laws that were found in the Ten Commandments, some of that is given here in chapters 21 through 24. And that's what we're getting into now. All right, let's go to question number one. What's chapter 22 about? All right, various circumstances and particularly about property. Question, same question, chapter 23, what's it about? All right, deals with the Sabbath, with justice, fairness, and three annual feasts that the males were to make their way to Jerusalem to celebrate. Chapter 24, something Hebrews 9 talks about. Yeah, very good. Covenant ratified by blood. All right. Let's get a couple of other questions out of the way. Question number one, what was the punishment for theft? Restoration, yes. And in one case, fivefold, and in another case, fourfold, as we see in verse 1. Question number 3. Why was a man not held guilty for slaying someone that's caught in breaking into his house? Yeah, he was protecting his property and his life. We'll say more about that. Let's get one more question here. What responsibility did one assume? Let me rephrase that. I'll reread that. Question four. What responsibilities did one assume when he was entrusted with another's goods? All right, very good. All right, let's look at chapter 22. Now, these are some miscellaneous laws. It may seem to you, as we mentioned last time, like the book of Leviticus, like we're reading a phone book. And yet these were laws that God gave that are amplification of the laws of chapter 20 of the Ten Commandments, which would be a summary, basically, of the law. But these were the Ten Commandments. But then here are some of the details of the law. For example, you should not bear false witness. Well, there are numerous things about false witnesses found here in chapters 22 through 24. So we have property laws first, and then we have some miscellaneous situations that we'll get to. Let's talk about the property laws. Here's what I want us to look for. Not that we live under these laws. We don't. These principles, many of them are found in the New Testament. And so I want us to look at some very practical things. We'll try to stop at the end of each chapter. And what did you see practical? For example, let's get ahead of ourselves. Like at verse 2, we're going to learn that not all killing was murder. It's very practical. And we'll develop that a little more. Those kind of practical things that would fit in our life, we can take the principle, plug it in, or we're going to learn the principle of treating other people fairly. God wanted people to be treated fairly because he's a gracious God. He mentions that. We can take that principle and plug it in New Testament times. Make sense? All right, let's get underway here. Here are property laws. So very little is given to each one. By that I mean there's not like 10 or 20 verses for each law, but sometimes just the statement of the law. So here's the first. The restitution for stealing in verse 1, if a man steals sheep, ox, or etc., and he either slaughters it or sells it, he's to restore it fivefold for oxen, or fourfold for sheep, So if a man's caught stealing and he is found with that and he's either sold it, done whatever, he's to restore that restitution. And I'm learning a very practical thing from that, and that is we bear responsibility for what we do, and God expects us to make some kind of restitution for our wrong. Now, there's some things you can't do. You kill somebody, you can't bring them back to life. You can't go get another life and bring to them. But there are times that God expects restitution. Try to make things right when you've done someone wrong. All right, let's go to the second one here. This is a very powerful in verses 2 to 4 about catching a thief. Might underline some things at verse 2 because let me preface what I'm about to say. If you feel like you could never defend your life, then don't do that. Let the thief kill you. Let the murderer kill you if you don't feel like you could defend your life. But for those who do think they could defend their life, the argument against that is that that's killing, and Bible condemns all killing. Well, Exodus 20 said, thou shalt not kill, and the person who kills would be put to death. But here's a case where you kill someone and they were not to be put to death, which tells me, by conclusion, not all killing is equated with murder. Does that make sense? All right, let's see what that says. That if the thief is found breaking in and he struck so that he dies, there shall no be guilt, shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. In other words, you'll not be held accountable. But if the sun has risen on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. In other words, you can't chase him down. He's breaking into your house, and you feel like your life is threatened, you could kill him. But you don't go chase him down, and the next day when you finally catch him, now I'm going to kill him. You're guilty of murder. That applies in our life, in our society, as far as civil law is concerned. If you've ever taken the gun permit laws, you can, if they're breaking in on you, you're justified in shooting them. But you don't chase them down through the neighborhood and get them downtown, then shoot them. You're going to be in big trouble. No matter what your belief on that is, that's what the law is. And perhaps based on this kind of principle. But now at verse 3, what else do we see? If you find him and chase him down, but you can't kill him, he's going to have to do full restitution. And if nothing is found, if he has nothing, then what do you do with him? Sell him as a slave because of the theft. Verse 4, if the theft is certainly found, that is, if what he stole is found on him, whether it be an ox or a donkey or sheep, he shall restore it double. And so he's to restore that. So here's restitution. Make sense? All right. So here's property laws. Restitution for stealing. What about catching the thief? Let's go to verse 5. Here's something about the animal entering someone's field. What's this law in verse 5? Yeah, you're responsible for the action of your animals. If your animals gets out and grazes in your neighbor's field and destroys his crop, his vineyard, whatever it may be, then you're to take from yours and restore that back to him. And so you're responsible for the behavior. So the same is principle. There are laws in play. Your dog bites somebody, you're responsible. Your animals get out and cause a wreck on the highway, you're responsible for that, even in our own day and time. Now, verse 6, here's another law about loss through fire. If a fire breaks out, and I take that's accidental, where you're burning thorns, and so that the stacked grain or the grain of the field is consumed, the one who kindled it shall make restitution. You're responsible. Here's an accident. You didn't mean for that to happen, and it breaks out, and so you're to make restitution for that. Now, we'll come back and look at some practical things in a moment. Let's finish these laws. Look at verse 7 through 13. We have a section here dealing with the loss of good entrusted to a neighbor. What's this about? All right. Very good. Do you remember last time, if you were not here, you might want to go back and do this. Chapter 21, verse 22, you might circle the judges, underline the judges, flag that for attention as you come back through the book of Exodus later. And it was those that were to execute the eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth of verse 24. Well, here we have the judges mentioned again at verse 8 and in verse 9. That is, in the case of the loss of property that had been entrusted, if a thief stole it, then the thief is responsible. And so if the question comes into play, did the one I entrusted with it stick his hand into it and steal it? Then you go before the judges, and the judges make the determination of what's to be done about that. And whoever they determine to be guilty is to pay double to his neighbor. Why double? Versus the fourfold and the fivefold of verse 1. I don't know. Colin David suggests maybe because that which was stolen wasn't consumed, maybe. And that's about the best I can do with that. Now, at verse 10, if a man's donkey delivers a donkey to his neighbor, a donkey or an ox, etc., and it dies or is driven away, then an oath between them, so this is a different circumstance. It wasn't stolen. It dies or it somehow disappears. Then when the one seeing to it swears that he did not take it, what's the owner to do? Accept that. And he doesn't have to make it good. But if it is stolen, he has to make restitution for the owner. What if it's torn in pieces? He said, well, an animal came by and killed your ox while I had it. Give some evidence, prove that, and then he's not responsible for it. Now notice verse 14 and 15. Then we'll stop and learn some practical things. The responsibility of borrowed goods. If a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it becomes injured or it dies, he borrows an ox, he borrows a donkey, etc., and it's injured or dies, the owner of it not being with it, he shall surely make it good. In other words, you're responsible. You borrowed it and you put it to use. Something happened. You bear some responsibility for that. But what's the circumstance of verse 15? Yeah. Yeah, it was. That was part of the hire. That was part of the deal. And he's responsible for taking care of his own. Much like you borrow someone's vehicle, and you may be responsible for it if you wreck it. But if you ask them to come and do something for you, and you're borrowing them and the vehicle, and they're operating it, and they wreck it, well, then that's their job. They should have been watching and taking care of that. The same kind of principle. All right, what practical things do you learn from that? Now, that deals with property, but there's certain practical things you learn that we can plug into our present day. What do you learn? Yeah, learn a lesson about personal responsibility rather than blaming everyone else, even in cases of accidents. This was an accident. I didn't mean for the fire to break out. Didn't mean for the animal to die. Didn't know it was going to get stolen. There's some responsibility borne. Personal responsibility. What else do you learn? Yeah, there's all through these laws in chapter 22 through chapter 24, 22 and 23 particularly, are laws that have to do with respect and care for other people. You show some respect for them and you care for them, and there's fairness of how you treat other people. And we'll see more about that here in chapter 23. Anything else from the first 15 verses? All right, let's go to the next section. Here's some miscellaneous situations. And so let's start with verse 16 and 17. And what's this about? If a man, he goes and he entices a virgin and he lays with her, and she is not betrothed, and she's not promised to someone, she's not engaged to someone, she's not supposed to be getting married to someone. What's he responsible to do now? Pay the bride price. Not given here. If you want to make a marginal note for future reference, Deuteronomy 22, 28 and 29. I'll give you the verses again. 50 shekels he was to pay. 50 shekels, Deuteronomy 22, verses 28 and 29. Deuteronomy 22, 28 and 29, 50 shekels. So that was the bride price. Not given here, but given later in some details of the law. But if her father refuses to give her, then he's to pay the bride price of virgins. In other words, he bears some responsibility for his carelessness and his immorality. Does that make sense? He bears some responsibility for that. All right, let's get the next one. Sorceress is to be put to death. This would be, some translations will use the word witch or for witchcraft, those who perform evil deeds. And so you're not to permit a sorceress or a witch to live. One who claims to work magical spells, etc., they are to be put to death. They are contrary to God. They think they have powers of God. They're not to live. No different than an idolater. Verse 19 talks about bestiality. The one who lies with a beast is to be put to death. That was capital punishment. God didn't think much of that. Now, we get a little later on in the book of Leviticus, we're going to see that even adulterers were to be put to death. That if you committed adultery, be put to death. God didn't think much of sexual immorality. Now, what's the next one at verse 20? Yeah, idolatry. If you sacrificed any other god except the Lord, you shall utterly be destroyed. That's an amplification of part of the Ten Commandments, as you'll recall. All right. Now, verse 21. Now, this is repeated more than once, and I've flagged verse 21 here, and we're going to flag another one. What's verse 21 say? Don't mistreat a stranger. Your footnote will say sojourner. In other words, someone passing through that's not a part of Israel, someone from a foreign land, they're going to pass through Israel. And when they do and they come through, don't mistreat them because they're different and because they're strange in a different nationality. Why? All right, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. You were a sojourner in Egypt. In other words, you were strangers in another land. Now let's flag a verse here that'll help us connect some verses, chapter 23 and verse 9. It says essentially the same thing. We'll come to that later. So jump on over to 23 and 9 and flag 22, 21. That helps me to tie verses together. May not help you, but that does me. So 23, 9 and 21, 22, 21 tie together. They say essentially the same thing. Don't mistreat others. In other words, treat other people the way you'd want to be treated. You are a sojourner. They're sojourners. Treat them like you wanted to be treated. You don't want to be mistreated. Now, verses 22 to 24 talk about not afflicting the fatherless and the widows. They're often connected together. Other than their helplessness is the idea of their connection. That's the only connection I know of. Don't afflict the widow or the fatherless child, the woman who doesn't have a husband to care for her, or the fatherless child who has no parents to care for them. Now, what does he say about that 22 and 24? 23 and 24. Yeah, I'm going to take care of you. So you mistreat your own people. And so you mistreat the stranger, you mistreat the fatherless, you mistreat the widows, then I'm going to kill you. And I'll hear their cry and I'll answer that cry. Now, there are several things about the poor in this, and I want to say more about the poor a little bit later in chapter 23. But let's talk about lending to the poor. That if you lend money to the poor, what were you not to do? Charge interest. In other words, don't take advantage of the poor. So we're going to try about three principles together before we get through about the poor. Don't take advantage of the poor, nor is your sympathy for them to cause you to do something unjust. We'll get to that later, but that's not in this verse. We'll get to that in chapter 23. But if you lend money, don't charge interest. Now, I think of Nehemiah chapter 5. Remember what happened in Nehemiah 5 when Nehemiah came on the scene? What you're doing is not good. They were exacting usury. That's an exorbitant amount of interest. They were selling, they were buying land from people and loaning them money so that they could have what they needed and taking advantage of the poor. And Nehemiah condemned them for that. Leviticus 19 goes through all of that. We'll talk about when we get there. Now, if you take your neighbor's garment as a pledge, what's the pledge? Surety. Collateral is what we would call that. And so there, your poor neighbor needs some money, and so you give them money and loan them money, and you take their garment as a pledge. What are you supposed to do with that? Give it back to them quick as you can. Give it back to them as quick as you can before the sun goes down. For this is his only covering in the garment, and what's he going to sleep in? And when he cries out, I'm going to hear, for I am gracious. Now, what do you make of that phrase, for I am gracious? All right. God's saying, I care about the poor. I'm gracious toward the poor. I'm compassionate. I have respect for the poor. I expect you to do the same. Does that make sense? Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm learning this principle. Let's get ahead of ourselves. We're going to stop when we get through verse 31 here in a minute. Verse 31 and see what we learn practical from this section. But one of the things I'm learning from verse 27 is the fact that God cares and wants us to have respect and care for other people. And so don't take advantage of them. Now, verse 28 causes a little consternation. And it has to do with do not curse God or the ruler of the people. Now, if you're reading from the King James Version, and it's the only one that does this that I know of, and that you shall not revile or curse the gods, plural. And so there's some question, is that referring to gods, as in lowercase g? Remember, capitalization is supplied by translators, so if you're looking at your translation, say, well, it's a lowercase g, so I know it's not God, or it's a capital, and so I know it is. The translators did that, so that didn't help you at all. This comes from the word Elohim. Same word in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It's plural, but as plural, it can be, in the Hebrew, it can refer to God, the one true living God, or it can refer to the gods, lowercase g. So what does it refer to here? Well, the King James translators seem to think that it was talking about the gods. But it would seem in the context, in the flow of the context, that the next one, the ruler of the people, is not something that's in connection with the gods, lowercase g, but in connection with God. In other words, those in leadership, so don't curse God, nor those that rule, the ruler of the people. So don't defame them. And I think that makes flows in the context. Now, let me give you further evidence of that. We'll come to verse 30 in a minute. But go, let's drop down to verse 31. You shall be holy men to me. They were to have reverence for God and be holy in their direction toward God. I think that helps me interpret. Maybe it doesn't, but I think it does interpret what the God refers to, or Elohim refers to, in verse 28. Let's talk about offering the first fruits and finish that section. What are the first fruits? Say again. Yes, not only the first, but it's the very best of the fruits, thought to be the best of whether it be the animal, be your own children, be the crops. So let's get what he says here. Do not delay to offer. What I take from that, there may be a tendency to delay to give their offering. Here's my first fruits, and I'm not sure I want to give it just yet. Don't delay to give the offering of the first fruits of your ripe produce and your juices. Your translation may, I believe it's the King James, uses the word liquors. Not likely referring to what you think of in our day and time as liquors. It probably refers to the juice from the vine or the fruits. Some have even translated it your ripest of fruits, thus the juices. I'll leave that for you to work out. The firstborn of your son shall be given to me, likewise also your oxen and your sheep. Now notice at verse 30 that the sheep will be given with its mother 7 days, and on the eighth day you shall give it to me. Why? I don't know. Some think that it corresponds with the 8 days in circumcision. I don't know the connection there really. But others suggest, which makes a little more sense, that maybe the 7 days it stays with its mother, that from being unclean from the birth, that gives it time to be a clean animal to be offered to God. So notice the next phrase at verse 31, you shall be holy people to me. God deserves the best. He's asking for the first fruits. So this animal, as it's born, is not to be given to God just yet. If you've ever been around the birth of an animal, a dog or a horse or a cow, it can be nasty right at the first, can it? And so 8 days later, it's more clean to offer it to God. Maybe that makes sense. God deserves the best. Does that make sense? Now, is that the explanation? I don't know. We're not told. That one made more sense than any I read. Now, verse 31, you should be holy to me, and you should not eat any meat torn by the beast, but you're to throw it to the dogs. So don't eat that in any way of sacrifice and honor to me. Practical things you learn from the miscellaneous situations. Chapter 23. Or 22, I'm sorry. All right, things that we think to be small. Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, God demands to be first and foremost. I see the death penalty comes to play. We hear about God being such a loving God, and quite often if the death penalty is being executed, there's an execution taking place, it's religious people who are protesting that we need to love them, da-da-da-da-da, and yet God said, the one guilty of this to be put to death, the one guilty of this to be put to death, God believed in capital punishment. Let's move to chapter 23 now and go further with these miscellaneous laws. If we can get through 23 and 24, then we get into the tabernacle and perhaps a little more exciting to some of us. Now, we have all of these categories right here, and we're going to subdivide several of those. So let's start with justice. And we'll pick up our pace a little bit in interest of time. Notice at verse 1, do not bear false witness. That's an amplification of one of the Ten Commandments, you remember. Verse 2, closely connected, don't follow the crowd to pervert justice. Now, most of the time when you hear this quoted, it's don't follow the crowd to do evil, and a good application of that. But don't follow the crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. You might flag verse 23 as connecting with that. I won't go there. We'll get to that a little bit later. But verse 23 has a similar connection. So when the crowd thinks this person is guilty, whether he is or not, don't go with the crowd to perverse justice. Don't stick your finger to the wind and say, I want to go where the crowd is. You want to go with what's right and where the evidence is. Make sense? That's how justice is to be executed. Now, verse 3, I want to make a point about verse 3 and verse 6. We already talked about lending to the poor. Don't take advantage of the poor. But here's something else about the poor at verse 6. You shall not pervert, or verse 3 rather, you shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. What do you learn from that? All right. Judge the facts and not the person. So don't feel sympathetic toward him merely because he's poor. Oh, the poor guy, he doesn't have anything, he's poor, and so we're going, I think he's innocent. Don't do that. That has nothing to do with his innocence. He stole, he's guilty, poor or rich. Doesn't make any difference. Let's get ahead of ourselves to verse 6 and tie that one with that. And verse 6 says, you shall not pervert the judgment of your poor in his dispute. What do you learn from that? Very similar, but goes further. Yes, goes in the opposite direction. So don't favor him because he's poor. Don't be against him because he's poor. His poverty has nothing to do whether he's innocent or guilty. Does that make sense? So he's accused of stealing. Well, bless his heart, he's poor. Doesn't matter. Or I bet he did steal because he is poor. Doesn't matter if he's poor. Where's the evidence? Does that make sense? God wants us to look for the evidence. All right, let's go back now to verse 4 and 5. What do you see in verse 4 and 5? This is something that Romans 12 tells us we must do. Yeah, so you treat your enemy well. Romans 12 makes this point, and Jesus made that point in Matthew 5. God wants us to treat our enemies. Instead of saying, you know what, he's my enemy, that's his ox, I ain't going to tell him, I don't care what happens to his ox, you take it back to him or you help him with his burden. We've already covered verse 6, so let's go to verse 7. The innocent's not to be punished due to false accusation. I'm just going to leave that one with that comment. Verse 8 says, take no bribes. And I'm more interested now at verse 9. What does verse 9 tell us? Yeah. Yeah, you don't mistreat the stranger. And we need to flag what verse? 22:21. Yes. All right. Let's talk about that's justice. Various principles of justice. Now he talks about some Sabbath laws. And so let's look at two things concerning. There's the Sabbath year. And then there's the Sabbath day. And that is, you're to work your ground for 6 years, and the seventh year, you let it rest and let it lie fallow. And that the poor, in other words, there's going to be that year, if you've raised even a garden, but crops, you know that the year you don't raise anything, you're going to have some volunteer things come up. So the crop may spring up partially. And so what are you going to do with that crop that comes up? Yeah, that the poor may have it, and that the poor may eat. So you're going to take care of the poor. So you see the poor mentioned four times already in our context. Now at verse 6, this is a repeat of remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. So what does verse 12 and 13 say? I said verse 6, verse 12, verse 13. You're going to work 6 days, and then on the seventh is the day of rest. Not only you rest, but your servants and your donkeys, and the stranger. And might underline it, verse 13, you're to be circumspect. What is the word circumspect? We don't use that every day. If I walked up to you and said, have you been circumspect today? You'd probably say, what? walking wisely, carefully, deliberately. Be very circumspect. In what way were they to be circumspect? On the Sabbath day, they were not to even mention the name of another God. All right, now we're ready to talk about three annual feasts. So three times a year, there was a feast. And we'll see what they are in 15 and 16. Let's get ahead of ourselves to verse 17. Three times a year, your males shall appear before the Lord your God. All right. So three times a year. So what we have is the Feast of the Unleavened Bread that you might notice at verse 15. The Feast of the Unleavened Bread, which was established in Exodus 12. Remember that? As we were going through our review of chapters, I flagged that as we went by. We'll come back to that. There's the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, they would eat unleavened bread for 7 days. Then there is, at verse 16, the Feast of the Harvest, or it's also been referred to as the Feast of the First Fruits, or Pentecost. That was a feast of 50 days, hence Pentecost. So after the Feast of Unleavened Bread, at the end, they were then to shoot toward this. We'll get the calendar on that in just a moment. Then there is the Feast of Ingatherings, and that is at the end of the year. And that's not at the end of their calendar year, but at the end of their harvest is the idea. And that is the same as the Feast of the Tabernacles or the dwelling in booths. Remember that? The dwelling in booths Nehemiah talks about. All right, now let's get that on a calendar. You've seen this many times, so to remind you where we're going with this, this is our calendar, January, February, March, April. So around April, there is the month Nisan. Well, you say, but my text says Abib, the month of Abib at verse 15. Well, Abib was changed to the name and called Nisan by the time of Esther 3 and 7. You might flag that in the margin of your text. Esther 3, 7, Nehemiah 2, 1. This same month, Abib, which was the first month, this is the first month of their year, this is the start of their calendar year, Nisan, that they have the Passover. Here's the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So here's the first feast taking place in that month. 50 days later, they have the Feast of Pentecost, the second one mentioned here, and then later in Tishri, was close to our end of September, was their Feast of Tabernacles or Dwelling in Booths. Those were the three annual feasts. Make sense? Details are not given here. Details are given in Exodus 12 and further and later in the book of Leviticus. Let's talk about sacrifices. Verse 18, they were not to sacrifice blood with unleavened bread, nor the fat of the sacrifice remained to the morning. Now at verse 19, here's their first fruits again. And here's a statement we find three times in the Old Testament. You shall not boil a young goat with its mother's milk. We see that again, if you want to make a reference, chapter 34 and 6 and Deuteronomy 14, 21. You may have marginal notes to that effect. Deuteronomy 14, 21, Exodus 34, 26. Probably that had reference to just diminishing cruelty toward animals. Some think, and go at length to make this, though I'm not sure there's an abundant evidence of it, that this was maybe some practice of idol worship. And so either way, don't boil a young goat in its mother's milk. And whether that's the cruelty of animals that's to be discouraged, or don't practice what the heathen is practicing, just don't do that. God didn't explain why, and I guess he didn't need to tell them why. They just need to know they don't need to do it. All right. Now, let's move on to promises if you obey. Now we get into probably the most difficult section of the whole section tonight, and that is, who is this angel? Basically, let's get the overall view of what's going on in 20 to 31, and that'll nearly get us through with this chapter. God's saying, I'm going to go before you. Forget the angel for a moment. We'll come back to that. And if you'll obey me, things are going to go well. We're going to go into the land, and I'm going to drive out the people, and you're going to be obedient, you're going to be blessed, and things are going to go well if you obey. If you don't, it's not going to go well. That's basically it, isn't it? All right. But God said, I'm going to send an angel before you. Who or what is the angel? Some say Moses. And yet, I think Pulpit was correct in saying that some of the statements that he will or will not pardon you is kind of a tall order for a man named Moses. So this seems to be either, it just simply means an angel means a messenger. Same word that's used with reference to the angel stopping the hand of Abraham in Genesis 22. So who or what is it? Pulpit thinks that it has to do with the Son of God. It's the Christ, the second being of the Godhead. I'm not sure about that. I think Haley leans in that direction. I didn't go back and check Haley's. Haley doesn't have a commentary on this, but he has an oral commentary that we can all access. And I understand he takes the position that it does refer to the Christ and argues from 1 Corinthians 10 concerning that rock which followed them, and that rock was Christ. Maybe so. Colin Dalich thinks that it's a manifestation of Jehovah, and I'm just going to have to leave it at that. It's somehow a messenger going forth, be it a manifestation of Jehovah himself, or is this the Son of God? Likely so, possibly. God said, I'm sending an angel. Now, you're to obey his voice, verse 21. God's name is in him, verse 21. He is referred, the angel is referred to as my fear, verse 27. And so, who or what is it? Some manifestation of God, or maybe the Son of God. And I can't go much further than that. All right. Now, in interest of time, notice it, verse 24. You're going to obey, and I'm going to drive out all the people, and then you shall not bow down before them to do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow and completely break down their sacred pillars. But now, verse 29, what's God say? When you go into the land, yeah, it's going to take some time, and so this is a gradual process. So here's something very practical I learned, and that is I learned that progress does not always come suddenly. Sometimes the progress we are making is gradual. We're going to see year by year some progress. Now, the last two verses make no covenants with the Canaanites. Don't have anything, lest they be a snare to you. And so let's quickly get chapter 24. We got a couple of minutes to go. This is the ratification of the covenant. So now this is an important chapter, as all chapters are. Moses was asked to come bring Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, etc., bring them, and Moses then tells the law to the people, what he's just learned. And twice they made this statement, all the words which the Lord has said, we will do. That's not sufficient. That's not good enough yet. So he wrote all the words down, and he took the blood from the sacrifice and put half of it, he took half the blood and put it in the basins, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant and he read it to them, and they said, all that the Lord has said, we will do and be obedient. Then what did he do with the blood? Verse 8. Sprinkled it on the people. Now, I might put out to the margin of your text, Hebrews 9, verses 18 and 19, where the old covenant was dedicated by blood, just as the new covenant is dedicated by blood. So when you get to Hebrews 9, you say, well, when was that? You just studied it tonight. That's what we just read. So the old covenant was dedicated by blood. So there was a ratification of this law, and here's the sealing of the law, and it was dedicated by blood. Now, 9 through 11, we have Moses and Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu. They went up, and they saw God. They saw a vision. Some say they saw the Son of God. Some think they think they saw God. I don't think they saw God. No man has seen God at any time, the text would tell us in other places. So they saw a vision of God. So what's the point of this vision? I think it was to overwhelm and see the power and the might behind the law that has been uttered and is about to be written on the stones. Does that make sense? God does this constantly, particularly in Revelation, overwhelm them with his greatness. All right, let's get the last section here. Then Moses, in verses 12 to 18, God calls him up to the mountain, and he says, I will give you the tablets of stone. That hadn't come yet, even though he's given the Ten Commandments. The tablets of stone haven't been given. And bring your assistant Joshua, verse 13, might flag that. I don't think we've come across Joshua before, but he's not been called his assistant till now. I may have missed that. If I did, I'll correct that. But I think that's the first time that's been mentioned. And Moses and Hur are with you. Who is Hur? We saw him earlier. What did he do? Chapter 17. Yeah, he held up the hands of Moses while the war with Amalekites were going. So who was he? We don't know for sure. The Jewish historian Josephus argues in Antiquities, his book Antiquities, volume 3, that it was Miriam's husband. Jewish tradition said it was Miriam's son. If that was a later view, her being her husband was an earlier view, according to Josephus. Was he? I don't know. There's no text that tells us, but Josephus seems to think so. All right, now let's get the last thing here. The glory of God came upon the mountain. What did it look like? It was like a consuming fire. The glory of God overshadowed the mountain. Moses is up. Aaron and Hur are down a little bit, and Moses is receiving the law. And how long is he there? 40 days and 40 nights. And what he receives, we'll see more what he does with what he receives as he comes down. He doesn't come down now until we get to chapter. He doesn't come down until we get to chapter. Anybody know? 32. Comes down in 32. And that's where we'll see him come off the mountain. All right, we're going to stop right there.